The following talk was from the Foundation's 6th conference at Quinta in April 2015. Session 2, Tuesday morning, Steve Maltz on Our Marvellous God.
Our Marvellous God. So, okay, I'm the meat in the sandwich between the two heavyweights. But I should say the meat is on the outside in this case. So I'm the flaky bread in the middle, which is quite a good link because it's bread is one of the things I'm talking about. So you may have noticed the three booklets on the back there. They're, again, with a lot of things that I write, it's not something I intended to write, but it just came to me that I wanted to do something that could actually reach out to people, but not in the normal sense of like a tract or an evangelistic book, but to produce something that is quite readable in its own right. So so water would be everything, you know, just looking at water from different angles, like the chemical structure of it or how water is used, but at the same time bringing in a Christian message, but in a very subtle way. So what I'm going to do in this short presentation is go through just some of the themes on all three of the booklets to show you what people would actually get from reading it. Now, each of these books will only take probably about an hour to read, so it's a great one to get for a friend who is a commuter, for instance. So this would be like a commute to work would actually, unless they're driving, of course, would actually sort of get them through the whole journey. There's a secret code on the back, which I'm glad that my friend Peter has just cracked, because it's something maybe only Christians will actually understand. But at the bottom is a sort of a content thing, and water has a one fish content, blood has a two fish content, and bread has three fishes. So those in the know of, you know, the ancient symbol of the fish should tell you that water has minimum Christian content for those that are most resistant. Blood has sort of medium Christian content, and bread has the most. So you can, it depends who you're dealing with, you know, which one you give to people. So that's the introduction. We'll now go into it. This is the first time I've done this, so anything can go wrong, particularly with the technology. Oh, that worked. Right. Water, the stuff of life. Okay, there was a recent TV advert where there was a sort of a model was drinking a glass of water, and the tagline was, "Water is so boring, why not have our fruit juice?" And I was thinking, well, boring, you know. You can imagine some enterprising firm coming up with sort of air with added designer vapors to make air more interesting. Perhaps a touch of nitrous oxide to make things amusing, or carbon monoxide to give a bit of an edge to it. But water, you know, it's unbelievable, you know, how non-boring water is, because all water is just three tiny atoms. But what atoms they are? Two hydrogens, the most basic and widespread element of all, connected to a single oxygen, the main component of the air that we breathe. And what we get H2O. H2O, probably the only chemical formula known by all, and a staple of the stupider variety of game shows, you know. What is H2O? You know, it's about the only chemical people can actually pronounce. So H2O, water, very important to us for a variety of reasons, for the need for survival, to the need to wash, something that fills up 72% of human bodies, but is needed by 100% of all of us. We all need water, but most of us, all of us, are mostly water anyway. This water needs to be extremely accessible. There needs to be a clean, consistent supply with safeguards to prevent loss through evaporation or contamination. Well, there's a system in place, and this is called the water cycle. We've all done this in geography, except for me, who didn't take geography, but I'm sure you did this in geography. So basically, you've got the water here on the groundwater. You've got the process of evaporation, where the water goes up into the atmosphere from the oceans, lakes, and streams. When it's in the air, it condenses into clouds, which are obviously very important for our weather and climate. So what happens here is that the water vapor wraps around small particles like smoke or dust in the air, forming these clouds. And then we get precipitation, something we know very well, usually on in Quinta, when we're at Quinta. But we've been blessed this year, haven't we? You know, how many times we've had rain out there, but I hope it's not too much of a, you're looking out there rather than looking here and wondering I should be out there. But I'm sure it won't rain this afternoon. You'll have a lovely time out in frolicking about in the woods this afternoon in beautiful weather we're going to be having today. That's for you, Yvonne. Right, so anyway, so the water cycle. So we've got the evaporation, condensation, precipitation. So you can see it's a cycle, it goes round and round and round. And when the water hits the earth, it seeps through the soil and just collects as groundwater, and then, as I say, goes round and round again. And that's why it's called a cycle. Well, this sort of system, this system has worked for centuries and centuries until we start messing it up. The Industrial Revolution came in the 19th century, and then pollution comes into the equation. As a result of this, we have to now use our ingenuity and our intelligence to create solutions to make sure there's clean water available for all. Of course, no system created is ever going to be as elegant as the original water cycle. And what this should do, this should be like the first little light bulb that goes off into your head, and it should beg us to ponder about the intelligence and ingenuity that created it in the first place. So in the booklet, it's just a little thing there, placed there, just to make you think, isn't that convenient that we have this system that just works for us, and it's only mankind that's ruined it through pollution. So let's think about rain. Weather forecasts tend to report on major rainfalls in terms of inches. So let's consider 1 inch of rain falling over an area of 1 square mile. So if you do your maths, that actually equates to 260 million gallons of water with a weight of just over a million tons. So prior to the deluge, we've got the situation of 1 million tons of water up there in clouds, hanging over an area of 1 square mile. You think, if that all came down, it's the equivalent, I don't know if you can see that picture, if that all came down at once, it's the equivalent of 500,000 small cars falling out of the sky in a short period of time. So you think, well, why doesn't the rain just fall down just like that? All, you know, one big sheet of rain just like all these cars falling down. Yet, it doesn't. What actually happens, the rain comes down very finely. We tend to think, you know, you can see the gentleness of the raindrops on the leaves. Yeah, even nature isn't destroyed by sort of the gentle rain that comes down. So it could come down like that, but in fact it comes down like that, apart from, of course, very heavy deluges. Again, it's almost as if the whole water cycle has been manufactured in order to ensure one thing, the sustaining of life on Earth. It's almost as if there are invisible hands out there guiding. So anyway, but we know this. This is our marvellous God, of course. Surely there must be intelligence behind this. Well, dare we think outside the box and actually consider that. Right. It's almost as if invisible hands, so you can sort of see the subtle the Blake picture. So this is the invisible hands of God actually behind the whole scenario. Thinking outside the box. That's how most of us are, inside the box, not thinking at all. Snowflakes. Okay. Well, snowflakes, interesting. We're going to look at snowflakes and examine the statement that no two of them are the same. It's this old cliche. Truth or legend? Well, first some background. The size and shape of snowflakes depends on how cold they are when they're formed and the quantity of water that is present. Between 0 and 3 degrees, we get thin hexagonal shapes. Minus 3 to minus 5, we get needles, and between minus 25 and minus 30, they become hollow prisms. So we can already see there's a degree of variety in snowflakes. But if we consider the original statement, in a sense it's unprovable because no one's examined every snowflake. You know, there's no way we can know that no two are alike. Who would actually know? But we can examine this from two different perspectives. Firstly, we can look at it from a very sort of scientific perspective. We can notice that a typical small snowflake would contain around one, what was that? I've got it written down somewhere, I think one trillion, it's either, it depends if you're American or English, it's either 1,000 trillion or 1 trillion water molecules. And these are never going to be arranged in the same way every time. So probability theory is going to tell you that our statement is about as true as you can get. But that's just one way of looking at it. That's how sort of the world would look at it. We'll look at it scientifically. But there's another way of looking at the situation. There's an alternative way of looking at most things. Well, we can look at the horizon at dusk and see a pleasingly random distribution of effects of electromagnetic radiation. That's what we're seeing here. Is that how we look at it? We can look at it scientifically, or we can just marvel at the beauty of a sunset. People pay great degrees of money to go on these Nordic expeditions to see the Northern Lights. Well, of course, all this is the solar wind and its electromagnetic sort of forces, but we see this as something that we're willing to pay vast amounts of money just to see in real life because of the sheer beauty and majesty of it, of God's creation. So no two snowflakes are the same. So we can either accept that dispassionately as a scientific fact, or we can marvel at the beautiful sweep of creation. There's another example. In the same way, we can gaze at a landscape from a high viewpoint and see the incredible shades and textures of the fields and trees and flowers and the sky. We're all different in the way that we view our world, but surely the capacity for appreciating such things defies the prevailing theory of us human beings just being sort of a bag of chemicals just randomly here as a result of evolutionary forces. We can look at it that way, and that's the way the world sees it, or we can see ourselves as a special creation who have been given this sense of wonder of looking at these things and actually seeing God in them and actually being attracted to God. And we need to use these ideas to really bring people in from the outside just to show them an alternative. Now, one person who worked on these ideas was a chap called Wilson Snowflake Bentley. Here he is, Wilson Snowflake. Okay, he wasn't christened Snowflake, that's his nickname, so Snowflake. Okay. He's a scientist from the last century, and he had a fascination with snow. And he had this to say, every crystal was a masterpiece of design, and no one design was ever repeated. When a snowflake melted, that design was forever lost. Just that much beauty was gone without leaving any record behind. I became possessed with a great desire to show people something of this wonderful loveliness and ambition to become, in some measure, its preserver. And that's what he did. He was a photographer, and he produced great books of photographs of snowflakes before they disappeared. Now, one writer, after interviewing him, wrote the following. But it is the snow that commands his real passionate interest. When he said that he wouldn't change places with Ford or Rockefeller, there was a ring of exultation in his voice. The indifference and ridicule of some people doesn't hurt very much. He feels that he is serving the great designer, capturing the evanescent loveliness, which, but for him, would be unappreciated, even unseen. And with that role, he is content. Well, within 2 weeks of publishing this book that he did, this first graphic book, he caught pneumonia in a snowstorm and died. How ironic. It's probably the way he wished to go. It's no joke. Right, it's no joke. Right, okay. Right. So, everything about what I've just said really depends on your perspective. Do we see the snowflake and the water cycle? Do we see purposeful design? Or do we just see an accident of nature? Well, we all know who that is. Richard Dawkins. Oh, it's just tweet, is it? Richard Dawkins, our great friend. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So that's sort of the, you know, the guru of the scientific establishment, and it really depends on your perspective. Okay, moving on to blood. Well, okay, blood. When it comes to connections, nothing does it better than blood. Silently and unseen, it relentlessly performs its functions within our body. All 5 liters of it. Blood is made of 55% liquid called plasma, which in turn is 90% water, and the rest of the blood cells, mostly of the red variety, and there are about 5 million in a cubic millimeter of blood. So, how does blood do its stuff? Blood clotting. Well, it's interesting to look at the mechanism for blood clotting. You can see the joke here, Dracula with his clot noodle. Don't know if you can see that at the back there. Blood clots, you know. Right. The mechanism for blood clotting. It's amazing. For our blood system to work efficiently, any holes that appear in any blood vessels need to be patched up straight away. Otherwise, we're going to have a slow puncture, or even worse, a flat. This is what happens. So any breach that we have in our blood vessels needs to be plugged up through the thickening of some blood into a clot. But there's balance needed, because too much clotting can disrupt other blood vessels and could lead to strokes or heart attacks or embolisms. Too little clotting can cause rebleeds. So it's like the balance has to be absolutely perfect for the system to work. So here we have the system. As soon as there's damage occurs, the blood vessel automatically constricts so that blood flows out more slowly, and the message goes out to these tiny particles called platelets, because they look like plates, little plates. These little fellas are created through a hormone in the kidney and liver and are stored in the spleen. And there are 100 billion of these are produced daily. 100 billion, these little platelets. Amazing. And each one would only have an active cycle of about 8 days. So when a blood vessel is damaged, it sends out a signal, and these platelets are summoned and then activated. Okay, so once they're activated, you then get a process, such a complicated process that requires 193 proteins and 301 interactions as part of this blood clotting process. And it all has to be done in the right order and, you know, with the right chemicals in the right proportion. It's just amazing the actual detail that has to be in place in order for blood clotting to work properly. So it's just amazing, you know, the idea that these mechanisms could have evolved by trial and error, as if you think about it, every mistake results in death. And so the knowledge of the mistake is lost. So how can the next generation get it right? So it should at least make you think a little bit about evolution versus creation versus design when you just look at just something simple like blood clotting. Okay, but the story does not end there. And to this, I have to thank, believe it or not, Mr. Hill, if he's still awake. I can't even see where he is. Because when we had a radio discussion on Premier Radio a few weeks ago, and we were talking about the Hebraic background of Jesus, and you brought up something very interesting, which I investigated, which I'm going to look at now, and you'll see what it is. It's vitamin K, blood clotting. I mean, this is amazing. It's been discovered that vitamin K is the vital element in the sort of the blood clotting process, so much so that its absence can halt the whole process. This has been seen to be a problem with newborns because of the deficiency of vitamin K in the first 7 days of life. So for the first 7 days of life, there isn't any vitamin K. So what happens is, for babies, in the first 7 days, they have to be given a supplement. So if they have any infection, they have to have a vitamin K supplement. So if there's any infection in the first 7 days, they're able to coagulate properly. Vitamin K only kicks in on the 8th day. So some of you are already, little light bulbs are going off into your head. What's the relevance? Well, here's a snippet, confuse a mull over. right. And this is regarding the circumcision of a Jewish boy when the foreskin is lopped off in order to comply with a key religious rite in Judaism. This ceremony is conducted, if it was conducted any earlier than the eighth day, then this little baby would bleed to death. So there's a reason why circumcision has to be on the eighth day, which is quite interesting, because, you know, how did the Bible know that? You know, this is, you know, there was no scientific knowledge when the Bible was written. You know, someone must have known. Someone who wrote the Bible must have known, you know, the science of vitamin K, that it kicks in on the eighth day. And we know that because it's in the book called the Bible, and we know the author of the book. So this is a great apologetic for God, you know. And, you know, this is, we build up to that in this book on blood, and there's no escaping this one. You know, it's in the Bible, you can see it, the eighth day, it's been there for thousands of years. How could human writers have known about this situation? So it's a real apologetic. Okay, the life is in the blood. What does that actually mean? Does this mean that we are not just a bag of chemicals, but something touched by the divine, like we're either that or we're that? Well, it's the DNA in our blood that actually connects us to generations, to previous and future generations. There, we inherit 23 chromosomes from each parent, who in turn inherit 23 chromosomes from each of their parents, and it goes right back as a sort of family tree. Our DNA is a vast store of information, unique to ourselves, carrying instructions from the maintenance of our bodies. It's our genetic fingerprint, unique to us, a boon to forensic scientists who use it now to solve criminal cases, and you can even fork out £125, discover your own DNA. You can send a bit of spit to someone with £125, and they can tell you what you're going to die of. think about it. Do you really want to know? I don't know. So problem is this view, DNA. We go right back, we go back generation, generation, generation. Eventually you've got to go back to the beginning, to the very first DNA, and you have to wonder where the first DNA comes from. It's such a complex chemical. It's full of information. Where does that information come from? So in the book, it just poses this question, you know, information has to come from somewhere. And of course, we know that comes from the Creator. Where did it begin? There we go. I don't know which one of these you'll identify with. We can do a vote if you like. No. Right. Okay, this was like the traditional view that we're, you know, monkeys to men. It's the traditional view of evolutionists. Then others have come up with this idea, perhaps we've come from outer space, on a little bit, a few chemicals on a meteorite. That's another way. That's been a bit of a cop-out with scientists. If they realise the flaws in evolution, okay, let's say that model may not work. Let's think of a more interesting model that we've come from outer space on a meteorite. And a few people have actually, scientists have actually proposed that. It's a chap called Fred Hoyle first came up with it. Because he didn't like evolution, he said belief in evolution is as if a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials within. So I don't know which, you know, I mean, okay, he thought that was bad, but what he's come up with is just as bad. So is there a third way? There's a third way, is the uncomfortable one, and it goes against the prevailing wind of our secular society. Why are scientists eager to accept the possibility even of extraterrestrial life but would not in a million years accept the possibility of a divine creator? They'll just try anything within their own frame set to come up with ridiculous ideas because they do not want to accept what we say is pretty obvious. This sort of tells it all. This is a quote from a scientist, Richard Lewontin, very interesting, I'll read it out. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, what we are forced to by our, this is all a bit complicated, isn't it? But it comes to an exciting ending, by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the initiated. Okay, you can ignore that. This is the crux. Moreover, materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So they'll come up with any bit of gobbledygook because they cannot allow the fact that there's a God that created everything. So our society is controlled by these people, you know, the cleverness of these people who want to trap us in a system that we know doesn't work, but because the alternative to them is unacceptable, so they'll come up with anything just to steer us away from what we know is the truth. So in my worldview, all of history is one grand drama with purpose, intent, and eventual ending, and blood is a key component to all of this. In many senses, it's the key driver because it provides an interface between the human and the divine. And to find out more, you'd have to read the book. Not my book, the book. Well, and my book, yeah, both books. Okay, we've done bread, and then we've done water, done blood, now bread. Take a load of flour, sprinkle in some salt and some yeast, mix it all up and add some oil and water. After a bit of squeezing and shaping, add some heat over an extended period and you get bread, the most basic, talked about and significant food in the history of mankind. It's not just about the eating of it. The very fact that a staple can be made out of such basic ingredients ensures that historically, farming became an alternative to wandering about, and ultimately giving rise to collectives and villages, towns, and then the great urban conurbations where most of us live now. So bread has very much influenced the way that we live. And it's not just in the making of it. We've got the metaphors from the slang word for money, bread, to the bread line, the measure of poverty, the idea of simplicity, when we have the expression bread and butter, and I haven't even got started on all the religious stuff. So the bread we eat is full of chemicals. The question we have to ask is whether the low price and perceived higher value or higher quality of our bread is really worth any sacrifices we make by having all these extra ingredients. Because there is a campaign called the Campaign for Real Bread Campaign, and they insist all we really need is to go back to this, 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 and this, the basic ingredients. Because they give lots of proof of how dangerous a lot of the additives have actually been, and we're not actually told about the dangers of additives in bread. One of them, there's a lot of enzymes that are not mentioned. One of them has been seen as a cause of asthma. Others have been known to cause diseases of the gut. So modern bread also is used, is created with more yeast than there used to be in the olden days. And this can cause problems as well. So what's this got to do with anything? Well, it's all about back to basics, really. That's the basic message. Real bread, getting back to the basic ingredients. Keep it simple, stupid. You've all heard of that. We all know about KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. It's just, you know, a good rule to live by, not just in bread eating and manufacture, but in the way that we live our lives. Let's look at the world of religion. The world of religion. Hierarchies. Where has the simple faith in a creator and sustainer gone? Instead, we have created these great hierarchies. Here we have the Roman Catholic Church, from the Pope all the way down to cardinals, archbishops, bishops, priests, deacons, and then the rest of you. Yeah, the great unwashed, that's us, the laity. You know, was this in the Bible? This is just something that we create. We make things complicated for ourselves. And that's just the way we are. The Bible provides a simple scheme, the Christian equivalent of the flour, water, yeast, and salt. The Bible speaks of elders, deacons, apostles, prophets. Now we've got all these extra bits and pieces, and all these have all got their own teams of administrators, and they have their strategic mission statements and whatever. It's so complex. There are many professing Christians who despair of the whole thing and pine for the simple days of spiritual bread. I can't do a Yorkshire accent. We nowt put in. Who's any Yorkshire men here? No one would want to be seen as a Yorkshireman. Right. Okay, I'm sure there are, but there you go. It's a matter of both false perception and bad representation. God has an awful PR team, I think, working for him at present. It's never really been that good. There was a time when public relations wasn't an issue, because if we go back 2,000 years ago, before dog collars and rickety pews and country vicars, things were a lot simpler. Back to that. Simple time is a representation. People met in their homes, often in secret because of general bad feeling towards followers of Jesus. They ate together, they listened to their teachers, they shared experiences, had fantastic experiences. We read through the book of Acts, and Chris has got loads of teaching on this subject of just reminding us of the simplicity of the old days, stories of great healings and miracles, exciting times, and they shared their possessions, people of generosity, people of joy, people of purpose. As their numbers grew every day, because others could see that they were people of action as well as people of words. Good deeds done through the overflow of love in their hearts, not just out of duty or for a good report or the promise of an earthly reward. It's just love would have driven everything. What went wrong? Something must have gone wrong, because the church of today doesn't exactly provoke any feelings of warmness, really, you know, to the outside world. Something has happened between then and now. Otherwise, the whole world, let's face it, would want some of that, you know, if we can really demonstrate miracles and healings and just pure love that we have for each other. Well, something has gone wrong. We've all got puffed up. See, back to the old bread again here. Puffed up. We read in the book about the function of yeast is the puffing up. We know from our theology that the matzah bread, the unleavened bread, is the bread without sin. And leaven and or yeast sort of signifies the sin that sort of added to the basic stuff. So we can see how we can be puffed up, which basically means being very full of yourself, being a big shot, arrogant, proud, and pushy. All puffed up. That's why I see. Okay, this has been in a paper recently. This is like a bishop, rather than doing what he's meant to be doing, like supplying spiritual solutions to the world, more and more churchmen are delving into the world of politics. So here we have a bishop looking through a keyhole at a political meeting, and he's saying, "Let us pry." right. Very good, rather than let us pray. So that really sort of sums it all up. Yeah, it's not just about modern times. You know, we can be despairing when we read of the church in medieval times, when teachings were promoted through fear and superstition, and people in general did not have a clue of what Jesus actually was all about. And here's a quote that sort of sums it up, all being puffed up. 1 Corinthians 8:1, and knowledge puffs up, but love builds up, or love edifies. And we need to get back to the simple stuff, love, rather than knowledge puffing us up and making us feel superior to everyone else. The fact is that historically, the church has tended to pay more attention to knowledge than love. Christendom has been more characterized by the wars fought over points of doctrine than by its love between its members. One just has to look at the time of the Tudors to see how many went to the stake or the gallows because of their interpretation of Christian doctrine, rather than any of the traditional reasons like murder or treason. It's just the fact that they believed differently, so off they went to the stake. You know, and this is in the Christian world. So does this mean that the teaching of Christianity stresses the need for defending doctrine by force, rather than showing the true love demonstrated by the one who started the whole thing, Jesus Christ himself? Certainly not, because we turn into Tudor times. As the average Christian had no access to the Bible in English, it's no wonder that their only reference point was that what the state-sponsored channels told them. So if anyone got hold of a Bible in English, they were persecuted. William Tyndale was persecuted. The Anabaptists were persecuted. Anyone during that time that had access to what God said, they were persecuted because the state church wanted to control them because this system was working, knowledge puffing up rather than the edification of love. And this is what we get, holy wars. And and we got to a situation, this is how the world sees this. I mean, we look at sitcoms and EastEnders, Coronation Street, and all over the world, when you see a Christian, they always tend to be very stern and unforgiving and judgmental. And I was thinking, the actual message of Jesus is a dangerous one and would turn the world upside down if it were followed correctly. Instead, we're not really giving that message out. People are seeing this type of attitude or this type of attitude in America. God hates fags. God hates you. You're going to hell. That type of attitude. That's the stereotype that we tend to get from the world. And that's because, in a sense, there's been a mix-up between state and church. Ever since sort of really the early times, the two have been so connected together. We're meant to be separate from the state, but the state and the church have tended to be mixed up together, and we have sort of state Christianity. We have sort of archbishops and bishops who, in a sense, to keep their popularity and standing, have to compromise to a certain extent to their political masters rather than really speaking out in truth on issues that are important today. So as I said, the message of Jesus Christ is a dangerous one and would turn the world upside down if it was followed correctly. So we look at the history very, very quickly. All this really came about starting way back to the Age of Reason. This is when man was sensed to become the center of everything. God was pushed to the margins and we became all that was important. That was a reaction to really the excesses of state Christianity through all the dodgy stuff that went on in the Middle Ages with the Catholic Church and the Inquisition and the Crusades and all that. It came to the point where man decided that only man knows the answers. The Age of Reason came in. Man became the center of all things. Humanism, which is still the prevailing sort of philosophy today, secular humanism, is what really controls our world. And it comes out of, again, secular means it's no way is it religious. Humanism puts us at the center. This is the default situation in our world. And we are really not a part of that. We are in the kingdom of God. We are not part of this. It's becoming increasingly difficult for us to stand up against this. And Chris hinted earlier of persecutions to come. And this is going to be a battleground between what we believe and what is the prevailing philosophy today. Man does not live on bread alone. That comes from the words of Jesus. So we're moving from the physical to the spiritual because he completes this statement by saying, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. So spiritual bread is what Jesus really represents. He goes under the saying of, I am the bread of life. He has a whole lot of names and titles illustrating different facets of his nature. But to identify him with bread is to bring us right back down to basics, to the world of staples. So we need really to get back to basics. And what has happened in our world? We get people like him, Stephen Fry, who can make these statements, where it shows you, how man thinks he's at the center of things, because he will dare to say, he's ranting at God by saying, how dare you create a world to which there is such misery that it's not our fault, it's not right, it's utterly, utterly evil. Which is amazing, considering he's an atheist who doesn't believe in God. He's ranting against God, and he's not alone in this. There are such other means, such as the dulcet tones of David Attenborough or Brian Cox, The great British public has been fed one side of the argument, and it's been fed very well by this side of the argument. It really needs an effort for them to see our side of the argument, to see what the real truth is. Do we let our trained celebrity thinkers, who we all trust, do the thinking for you? They can't all be wrong, can they? And that's it. You know, we blindly accept what we read in the editorials and on the blogs and the internet and the television. You know, we just, you know, if there's someone who's our favourite speaker, we listen to him and we think he's got the truth. But, you know, we can't be sucked into that. You know, we have to realise that we're you know, on a different plane. That is a loaf of bread. That's not a cap. On the, use your loaf. and that's what we need to do. There's a lot of places where we can hear chatter all over the internet. We've got Facebook and Instagram, Google, Blogger. It's confusing for us. It's confusing enough for everybody. We need to be able to chart our way through our complicated universe to find the truth. It's not as straightforward as it used to be. We have to find where God is in all these things. I can't remember. These are just symbols of how man can actually distract us and how man can actually sort of create things that take us away from God. We've got eugenics there. We've got the atom bomb. We've got warfare. We've got Big Brother. You know, it's all distractions. We've got the lottery. These are the people that, in a sense, are behind it. Descartes, Spinoza, Kant, Rousseau. These are the rationalist, humanistic philosophers who, in a sense, laid the foundation for the world that we're now living in. Perhaps they were wrong. We have to stand up and say they are wrong. Rationalism is not the answer to everything. We have a divine creator who is at the center of everything. So finish with a challenge. We must use our loaf to look at the world afresh and not through the lenses of others, being aware of the historic forces that shape the situation that we find ourselves at the start of the 21st century. We need to think for ourselves. It's not encouraged. We're not encouraged to think for ourselves. That's the problem with our world. Too many are willing to think for us, and we are too lazy to think for ourselves in general. Though, of course, you lot are different because you have thought for yourselves enough to come here when you can be doing so many more exciting things, I'm sure. But I know that's not true, is it? No. So that's it. So getting back to basics is what we're about. I'm about to finish. We're going to have a little bit of music. And then David Andrew is going to carry on the theme of getting back to basics, which is getting back to the person around whom everything, the whole world revolves, basically. So we're going to have, so you can sort of just stretch your legs a little bit, just be one song, and then David will come up and finish the morning session. Okay, thank you.
We hope you enjoyed that talk. To hear any similar talks from Foundation 6 Conference or any other of our conferences, please go to www.foundationsconferences.com. That's foundationsconferences.com. Thank you.